Welcome to Between the Lines. Listening to literature online. This is show number 129, The Mysterious and the Communal. Part 1. Title comes from a quote from the featured book. Both groups have lost their faith in the mysterious, the transcendent, the communal nature of religious experience. They depend on a learned set of ethical principles to maintain some semblance of order in their lives. This is from God is Red, A Native View of Religion by Vine Deloria Jr. Activist and a prolific author, Vine Deloria Jr. was recognized as one of today's leading Indian spokesmen. He has been executive director of the National Congress of American Indians and a member of the National Office for Rights of the Indigent. He is a practicing lawyer and was a professor at the University of Colorado Boulder at the Center for Native American Studies. Some other of his books are Custer Died for Your Sins and Behind the Trail of Broken Treaties. This is your host, Monk. Thanks for listening. Also adding that Vine Deloria Jr. was of the Standing Rock Lakota. Perhaps one of the first natives I've ever heard of to be not too many named Junior and Senior. It says on Wikipedia he was born in Martin, South Dakota, near the Oglala Lakota Pine Ridge Reservation, and studied English and Christian theology and became an Episcopal archdeacon and missionary of the Standing Rock Indian Reservation. Though much of this book is a comparison of Native ways with the Christian ways and Judeo-Christian, I actually learned a bit about my peeps and Hebrew history, and also got some different angles on Christianity and the Native perspective from the book. And this could be a bunch of part series. It's a wonderful book, which got a bunch, 40 something pages still to complete it, but wanted to get started. Have heard tons about Vine Deloria Jr. as one of the leading Native spokesmen and writers. Started to read a book he has comparing young Carl Jung with Native symbolisms and such like, and it's one of those deep thinking reads. So it's been on the shelf for a while, but this book is much more accessible. God is Red, A Native View of Religion. I guess a little tricky to describe in the sense that, well, from a non-Native perspective, it's I noticed that the stories, since Native people are known for being storytellers, the book goes in various directions. That it has a perfect flow to it, but somewhat surprising. One of the first notes made was after 1973, Pine Ridge, where Wounded Knee, the second Wounded Knee incidents, helped. It was creating a different sense of Indian identity was born. So that was the beginnings of the American Indian movement, which, in a way, he's saying that how catapulted into this more of the modern identity of Native peoples that we are more familiar with. And the book was originally written in the 70s, but this is an updated version 1994. And a historical anecdote showing the it shows a lot. This has to do with some incident in Tacoma, Washington. Almost 300 Tacoma City Police, state game wardens, and state police silently surrounded the camp. They trained telescopic rifles on the adult males who could be easily seen from the bushes in which the police force was hidden. Then the raid began. This is dealing with the Nisqually and the Puya, I don't know how to pronounce them all, but I'll try, Puyallup tribes. Tear gas was thrown into the camp, and the Indian fishermen and women were rushed and brutally beaten. As many as 6 policemen grabbed little Allison Bridges, a slip of a girl weighing less than 100 pounds and standing just above 5 feet tall, threw her to the ground and handcuffed her. People in the camp were arrested for disorderly conduct, although the disorder was police-inspired. The camp was leveled. The Indians' cars were impounded and taken to Tacoma, where they were virtually destroyed when in police custody. Dick Cavett allowed me to show pictures of the attack on the Indian camp on his national television show, resulting in a great public outcry against the actions of the police. As a result of the pressure, the federal government filed suit against the state of Washington and eventually won a ruling that entitled Indians of the state to receive an allocation of half the fish in the state. So this is, something to do with the fishing, since that's a big part of the Native peoples in the Northwest. This is around 1970, so, especially in light of what's going on nowadays, you can see that phrase, welcome to the reservation, that the Native peoples to really, this book is essential from what I've heard. It was recommended to me, and I'm finding it one of those essential books for understanding the Native perspective in a kind of cultural, spiritual, contemporary, political way. What I mean by that is that, some other wonderful books like the Genocide of the Mind and the anthologies that I've read from that show the Native, psychology of the Native peoples integrating in the American society or their spiritual practices. But this book tends to get at more of the sort of direct experiences in relation to what's going on. And it's sort of hard to describe, but I find it especially relevant in the sense that the way Deloria quotes various news and you know, he sort of shows the silliness of the sort of the mega church Christianity for sale preacher type thing that this stuff that we see nowadays spoofed on, say, The Daily Show and other comedy shows. But here's Deloria writing in the 70s and then later, and just showing this whole intermeshing of culture and religion and explaining it from a native perspective. So that's what I'm finding especially significant about this book. Yeah, just kind of read some bits. He starts off the book with describing this phase that went on that had to do with the grave robbing, anthropology students digging up, you know, graves of the native peoples, thinking that they were doing something to preserve history, and meanwhile, to the native people, it's a desecration. So, one aspect of the culture clash, and this is a fascinating bit. He gets at, Deloria goes really deep. He gets at the psychology behind things, and a lot of times he just poses questions. So it is very much like it's like sitting around talking with someone, or you know, the combination of storytelling and conversation that are exemplary of what I know of the native way. The grave robbing can be seen in another more profound and very disturbing light. Carl Jung, Swiss psychologist, suggested that we have a collective unconscious that lies behind, under, and in support of our conscious ego personality. In his Wotan essays, Jung related how he was able to predict the rise of National Socialism by analyzing the dreams of young Germans shortly after World War I. He suggested that at times an idea or archetype might sweep into the consciousness of many individuals who were otherwise not known to each other nor related in any way, and inspire or motivate them to perform simultaneously certain actions that they did not really understand. It was the propensity of whites during the summer of 1971 to grasp some bit of authenticity by locating, excavating, and embracing Indian skeletal remains can be interpreted as a frantic attempt to discard their own physical, cultural, and spiritual heritage. Then the collective psyche of white America was indeed deep in trouble. Fascinating on many levels there. So it gets into the AIM movement. Still a major topic, the violations of the Lakota treaties in 1868, a key date. And, you know, he references Russell Means and Dennis Banks, two of the most vocal and charismatic Indian leaders, occupied the headlines most of 1974. And other names that I've heard over the years. The second result of the Indian activist movement was the tremendous surge of interest in traditional religions and customs. At the BIA, Bureau of Indian Affairs, occupation, and again during the Wounded Knee confrontation, medicine men had been prominent in performing ceremonies for the activists. Leonard Crowdog served some time in a federal prison for his prominence in the protests of the 1970s. Frank Fools Crow, a leader of the traditional people at Pine Ridge, was the leading spokesperson during the meeting with White House officials in the summer of 1973. Years after Wounded Knee, Russell Means was asked what the beneficial results were, considering all the killings and violence that had infested the Pine Ridge Reservation during 1973 and for years afterward. He told a little story of watching three little Indian boys playing. The two more aggressive boys chose to be Means and Banks. They pointed at the third boy and said, "You have to be Dickie Wilson." The third boy went home crying. He was ashamed to even pretend to be a traitor of his own people. Somehow, through all of the protests and symbolic gestures, a different sense of Indian identity was born. Dickie Wilson was the head, I don't know what the official title, the head of the sort of Bureau of Indian Affairs installed tribal kind of chief, basically working with the U.S. government, selling out the people. That's was one of the crux issues of Wounded Knee. So you can see from a little bit of the quotes how, you know, we get this stereotype of Native peoples and the spirituality, but in this book he really gets at showing you the literal, you know, the hardcore stuff they have had and had to deal with, while also maintaining their own sense of religion or spirituality, whatever you call it, and doing that in the context of this, you know, dominant or, you know, imposing American culture, and you know what all that takes. And later on in the book, he does get into more of the sort of, you know, straightforward purist presentation of the spirituality psychology. But I think it's essential. You have to see it in context to really get what it means, some sense of what it means to be a Native person, you know, to see things from the Native perspective. And that's probably the biggest thing that this book has helped me to, just as he's writing and sort of talking out loud and sharing anecdotes, it just sort of subtly shifted my perception to see things better from, you know, whatever that means, to see things from this other perspective to the people, the real first of the Turtle Island here. So a lot of what he's charting in the book is this, you know, this new wave of what he writes as, you know, he's talking about the sort of presentation in books that had previously always been about natives of the past, and this whole, you know, sense of identity. You hear it with Americans say, "Oh, it was terrible what we did to the Indians," in this past tense. But you know, if you know anything about anything that's going on nowadays, you know that the harsh treatment has continued in many ways. It's similar to the what's going on with the blacks in the country. So Deloria, as I understand it, was one of the forerunners of this kind of putting Native ways into literature and books in a current sense, not just, you know, books depicting the past or the idealized Native or the Americanized view, but in their own words. So in that sense, he started this whole kind of renaissance of Native literature. But here's a little bit where he says, "Rather than a quiet group of civil servants, however, the younger Indians had become political theorists, activists, and cultural revivalists." So that helps to better understand, you know, what the natives are today. They're, you know, these generations, a few generations later on, that are emerging from what as some of the work that Deloria is charting. Here he writes, "What we dealt with for the major portion of a decade was not American Indians, but the American conception of what Indians should be. While D. Brown's Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee was selling nearly 20,000 copies a week, the 300 state game wardens and Tacoma City police were vandalizing the Indian fishing camp and threatening the lives of Indian women and children at Frank's Landing on the Nisqually River. It is said that people read and write history to learn from the mistakes of the past, but this could certainly not apply to the histories of the American Indian, if it applies to history at all." So, you know, he really highlights the, you know, while it's a progress to learn these things, but the actual realities of the moment, really is a wake-up call. Again, a lot of this kind of what he presents is in many ways, I'm finding, a blueprint for how to approach the world and news nowadays. And he talks about the you know, here in natives, I've heard Native peoples talk about the false shamans and those who abduct the Native ways for profit. And actually, some of the people I had heard of from my earlier years of just getting into, you know, New Age writings and stuff. Here is, "As the demand for authenticity increased, so did the fees paid to real Indians to hold ceremonies. Sun Bear, a Chippewa from Minnesota, created his own tribe, the Bear Tribe, and found a way to bring non-Indians into his own version of Indian ceremonial life. Eventually, he expanded and had an advertisement in Shaman's Drum, a magazine devoted to educating the thousands of young whites who wished to be Indians and shamans. The ad featured a nice picture of Sun Bear with the caption, 'Sun Bear needs spiritual warriors.' This ad exemplified the motivation of non-Indians. They wanted some kind of power so they could deal with their own culture and be successful. A variety of Indian medicine men and purported medicine men moved into white society where there were easy pickings. Whites would pay hundreds of dollars for the privilege of sitting on the ground, having corn flour thrown in their faces, and being told that the earth was round and all things lived in circles. The next step was performing sweat lodges for non-Indians. Another step was to cut out the best-looking blonde for a, quote, special ceremony in which she would play Mother Earth while the medicine man or whoever had conned the blonde would be Father Sky. They would couple to preserve the life on the planet. In short, the arena between cultures became a scene of intense exploitation. Oh, the other one here at the end of the book he goes at is Lynn Andrews. Her first book, first offering was Medicine Woman, in which she purported to have been an apprentice to a Canadian medicine woman named Agnes Whistling Elk. The narrative is thrilling because almost without pain or discomfort, Andrews is given all the secrets that every white person has sought for centuries. So, you know, he's highlighting that it's not just reading the book, it's not just doing these sort of watered down ceremonial things. You know, you can burn sage, that's fine, but it's not just burning sage that makes you, you know, and wearing jewelry that makes you become this sort of pseudo native. You know, it's really just, I think, a more understanding of what the realities of what they deal with is a better way to you know, in a sense, get what's really going on. And this is this bit of this chapter, The Indians of the American Imagination. In what has been called the New Age circuit, Indians have devised a clever answer to this question. They insist they are pipe carriers, an office that has rather hazy historical and cultural antecedents. No definition is ever given of the exact duties of the pipe carrier, except that he or she can perform all the ceremonies that a shaman can perform, without being called to account when nothing happens. This status was just what non-Indians need to avoid the accusation that they are practicing traditional ceremonies without any real knowledge or understanding of Indian ways. Now everyone from movie stars to gas station attendants is claimed to be an authorized pipe carrier. The belief is that one need only recite these magic words to turn aside all criticisms and skeptical expressions of the listeners. In the 1990s, Indian religions are a hot item. It is the outward symbolic form that is most popular. Many people, Indian and non-Indian, have taken a few principles to heart, mostly those beliefs that require little in the way of changing one's lifestyle. Tribal religions have been trivialized beyond redemption by people sincerely wishing to learn about them. In isolated places on the reservations, however, a gathering of people is taking place and much of the substance of the old way of life is starting to emerge. Some keen observers predict that within a decade, people serving on tribal councils will have to have a full traditional ceremonial life to get elected. So, you know, at least he's honoring the people sincerely wanting to learn about the tribes, but, you know, what that does, what the answer is as far as how they learn, that's tricky. I mean, I had experience, some of my first experiences of Native experience was when in Colorado and doing some pipe ceremony with someone who was a pipe carrier. Now, I don't know now if that person was legitimate, but, you know, it was, it taught me about, it was a different way of prayer and it gave me some experience. Actually, I would guess that it was not legitimate because of the way that I had heard to pronounce the word thank you in Lakota, and then later on learning that it wasn't pronounced the way that I had heard it in that from that ceremony. So that, you know, unless there's some kind of dialects, that would tend me to think that it was fake. But again, you know, I got something out of it, so that's some of what I mean by Deloria. You know, he raises a lot of questions. He's got strong views in presenting the information, of course, but he also leaves a lot open for the reader to think about. And again, knowing a little bits of another fake was the Education of Little Tree, a book I think that was on TV a while back. I remember seeing this little cartoon or whatever. But some, you know, sometimes very specific, helpful information. Like here in a footnote, he says, New Age gurus claim to be medicine people of an intertribal nature, which is traditionally impossible because individuals had to belong to one tribe or another. So, you know, sometimes you get into the logistics, the technicalities. Deloria was actually a lawyer, so he knows some stuff here. And another important aspect of the book is the interaction with the churches and the Christian, that whole angle of the Americana and how it's affected the native peoples, and a lot of natives have been Christianized and or part Christianized, and so have lost some touch with their own traditional ways. And that gets into a crux of the book, is comparing the native religion or spirituality to Christianity, and that's a fascinating crux of the book. And here he has some powerful words. In a real sense, Christian churches bought and paid for the Indian movement and its climactic destruction of the BIA headquarters, as surely as if they had written out specific orders to sack the BIA on a contractual basis. Not every Indian protest, however, was inspired by the financial rewards to be gained from the churches by playing the protest game. Many of the incidents were valid protests by people who had suffered too much for too long. Even more, younger Indians had seen in the civil rights movement that the institutions of this country respond only when there is a threat to their property or when disorder in their lives forces them to confront problems that have not been solved for generations. Yet the civil rights issue was peripheral at best when understood in the Indian context. The different tribal groups suffered discrimination and prejudice generally, but more specifically, the broken treaties meant immediate hardship for the different communities. Could young Indians enter a civil rights movement and press for removal of discriminatory hiring practices while enjoying preference under federal law for employment in tribal programs based on treaties and agreements? Major institutional differences really did exist among American racial minorities. So that was some of my understanding over the years is of the American Indian movement. It, coming out of just 500 years or so of oppression and colonization, and it just reached this point where something else had to be done. The collapse of the civil rights movement, the concern with Vietnam and the war, the escape to drugs, the rise of power movements, and the return to Mother Earth can all be understood as desperate efforts of groups of people to flee abstract articulations of belief and superficial values and find authenticity wherever it could be found. It was at this point that Indians became popular, and the widespread and intense interest in Indians as seen in the fantasy literature and anthology seemed to indicate that Americans wanted more from Indians than they did from other minority groups. For many people, the stoic, heroic, and noble Indian who had lived an idyllic existence prior to contact with whites seemed to hold the key to survival and promised to provide new meanings for American life. So again, he highlights this whole sense about who the native peoples really are and how Americans and others perceive them and what they're looking for from them in the context of looking for a grip on reality, whether it's through drugs, meditation techniques, protests, yada yada, that was big in the 60s that became this resurgence in interest in native ways that is a positive thing, and yet it's flavored with this sort of fadness, or what we now call trending, and that seems to be a major fault of the American culture, this sort of trending way that seems to avoid getting to the roots, the deeper stuff, which to me personally, that's what the native peoples represent to a large degree, is this ancient, timeless way of living, not only with the land, but with all the relations and just so many things that is it's the opposite of trendy. And another bit comparing the cultures. Thus, through nearly two decades, while American Indians were rediscovering the integrity of their traditional religions, the native peoples, he highlights time frame between 1887 to 1934 was a major, because of the oppression, a collective amnesia for a lot of the native peoples. So you have the native peoples, in many ways finding their own traditions again. Thus, nearly two decades
through nearly two decades while American Indians were rediscovering the integrity of their traditional religions, the rest of American society has torn itself and its religious traditions apart, substituting patriotism and hedonism for old values and behaviors. Why was it so easy for American Indians to recapture the essence of their religious life and so difficult for non-Indians to regain a measure of religious experience and stability? Here it shows how much, you know, everybody is really looking for their true traditions and their true paths. So, you know, it's fascinating how he highlights the, American culture sort of grappling with its own identity and how much is sort of fake religion, the patriotism and hedonism that, you know, comes into the religious and flavors it, and similarly various ways that natives, some of the corporate Indians that sell out to for the more Americanized lifestyle. So if nothing else, it's a complex mix of things going on. And wrap up this first part of a who knows how many part shows. At the end of this chapter, he's quoting Chief Luther Standing Bear of the Lakota tribe, commented on the strange feeling of alienation which the intruder experiences, and applied his analysis to the American whites as follows. The white man does not understand America. He is too far removed from its formative processes. The roots of the tree of his life have not yet grasped the rock and soil. The white man is still troubled by primitive fears. He still has in his consciousness the perils of this frontier continent, some of its fastnesses not yet having yielded to these questioning footsteps and inquiring eyes. He shudders still with the memory of the loss of his forefathers upon its scorching deserts and forbidding mountaintops. The man from Europe is still a foreigner and an alien, and he still hates the man who questioned his oath across the continent. But in the Indian, the spirit of the land is still vested. It will be until other men are able to divine and meet its rhythm. Men must be born and reborn to belong. Their bodies must be formed of the dust of their forefathers' bones. And in the last paragraph or so from Vine Deloria Jr., it is significant that many non-Indians have discerned this need to become indigenous and have taken an active role in protecting the environment. The patriotism of the American conservative may be said to be an expression of the effort to become indigenous. Certainly many Americans chafe at the idea that only Indians should be called Native Americans, and they argue quite properly that anyone born in the United States is a Native American. And that's interesting. The patriotism of the American conservative may be said to be an expression of the effort to become indigenous. So perhaps he's saying, you know, we're all kind of grappling with how to connect with where we are and in that way be indigenous. He continues, but their allegiance is to democracy, a powerful idea, but it has no relationship to the earth upon which we walk and the plants and animals that give us sustenance. Developing a sense of ourselves that would properly balance history and nature and space and time is a more difficult task than we would suspect and involves a radical reevaluation of the way we look at the world around us. Do we continue to exploit the earth or do we preserve it and preserve life? Whether we are prepared to embark on a painful intellectual journey to discover the parameters of reconciling history and nature is the question of this generation. Whether we are prepared to embark on a painful intellectual journey to discover the parameters of reconciling history and nature is the question of this generation. That highlights the kind of we're all in this together, and that so much from history has been stirred up. You know, they're native people struggling to find their own identities because of the assimilation and the genocidal ways and the colonization. And then you have, you know, non-natives sort of struggling to find their own identities. And so, you know, in all manner of levels of that. So as you can tell, it stirs up a lot. It's a fabulous book, and that'll wrap it up for part one. Thanks for listening.
And we'll go out with a track from an album, KSA, KSA, by the group Ghost Horse. With Tyogasin Ghost Horse, Cheyenne River Lakota on the flute. This is called Return the Black Hills.
Thank you.